RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome in, everybody. This is the Tuesday, July 30th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. Yes, when we reconvene on Thursday, it will be August 1st. We'll have our first preseason game, the Hall of Fame game, on Thursday night. And then the following week, we're going to have preseason football all around the league. And obviously, the 24th of August is the week zero in college football. So, folks, we are drilling down on it. Hey, listen, we had some health issues on Thursday. We apologize for the no-show there. We're back in the saddle today, and we're going to pick up, going to take you on Thursday. Going to get into defenses and the 3-4 defenses versus the 4-3. We're going to take you the next couple of days on that, and kind of get you through this next phase of the X's and O's. It's kind of what we want to try to do from this standpoint on this show. We have a couple of questions. We got several questions. We're backlogged on that as well. We're going to get to those today. Remember, if you've got a question, send them to go to LandryFootball.com, hit contact Chris, and send them to me there, and we'll get to it right here. Reminder, LandryFootball.com, got a lot of things planned, obviously, for this football season. The film breakdowns, breaking down the players, teams, and coaches' schemes, college and NFL level, get into roster player grades on rosters, and we're getting that all squared away for you. So you want to take advantage of the season special here by going to LandryFootball.com. So great opportunity to get involved on the website and get the daily information. Our notebooks every day will take you inside to what's going on at training camp in the NFL, roster movements, depth chart movements, who's looking well, how things are shaping up. Certainly the same on the college end. Yes, there are schools that now have started their practices, the week zero playing schools, that is, and then the rest of them will be starting soon. Who's going to win the starting job here or there? We're going to keep you up to date on everything going on around the college game and the NFL game in our notebooks. So check us out at LandryFootball.com. Let's get caught up on some questions before we get going and talking more X's and O's. Rock Wiss asks, college guy, but son of Hank Stram's Chiefs, would love to know if Landry ever talked to the Hall of Famer. His moving pocket was a big innovation, put him known as the Hank Stram's Wild West Variety Show. I did get to know Hank Stram really well. He coached the Saints as well and was a really big-time personality. He did a number of innovative things. The moving pocket was just one of them, as you well know. He also had the unique huddle. He didn't have the circular huddle. He started what was kind of a little church pew look where the quarterback's back was to the defense and the offense was looking up at him with the lineman in the back and the receivers and backs are up front, and that's how the huddle was set up for him. He had a lot of innovative ideas, and was a great guy, really, really good guy, and very, very opinionated. Did a really good job on some of the TV stuff he did and radio stuff. I thought he was one of the better guys, but very, very good guy, no question about it. An outstanding coach, no question. Lewis asks, during your discussion of the run-and-shoot offense in a recent podcast, almost as a throwaway comment, you said because of that offense, the Rams had poor special teams. Well, I didn't say the Rams had poor special teams because of the run-and-shoot offense. The Rams did not run the run-and-shoot. They ran their version, which was a lot different. But, yes, you're correct. The reason was their personnel didn't have the guys that made up good special teams. So they were missing a lot of tight end type guys. You mentioned that Chip Kelly became the Eagles head coach. He changed the defense from a 4-3 to a 3-4, and one of the reasons he gave was to improve special teams. I guess that both ideas was due to personnel, but I don't fully understand why this should be so. Well, it's one of the things you do with 3-4, the best cover guys on special teams or linebackers and safeties. So 3-4 gets more linebackers there, and it definitely does help you. The thing about the 3-4-2, I mean, it helps you on special teams, but what it does, it also gives you more flexibility where to bring that fourth rusher. But the reason why, if you say you don't understand why it should be so, it's personnel. If you have less linebackers on your roster, less tight ends on your roster, you're taking away the best type special teams players for you. I mean, safeties are big too. Corners are big, but are important. But you're taking away, you're taking less guys on the field at those key positions on special teams. That's the reason. So you're short personnel-wise relative to other teams at the NFL level. So hopefully that understands why. We appreciate that. Hopefully that explains it to you. So the reason the scheme dictates, in the case of the Rams, and it's more of an issue there, where they didn't have as many linebackers because they didn't have as many tight ends in particular. And the reason is they wanted more receivers because they ran more four wides. Well, you got to have more receivers if you're going to do that. Well, if you do that, now you're smaller on special teams on coverage, and you're not as good as a coverage team because you don't have as many tight end linebacker type athletes on your roster because you got to have more receivers. Only 53-man roster. So that has a tremendous effect. So hopefully that understands. The reason is your personnel is different because you got different type guys. So hopefully I explained that pretty well. But that it's not the scheme. It's the scheme dictates the personnel makeup on your roster. And the personnel makeup on your roster is going to affect greatly your special team. For example, too, let me give you another example of this. Let's say if you, in just the importance of, because the roster sizes are so small in the NFL, if you've got a receiver, if you got a veteran receiver, a veteran running back, and they're not a starter, like a big-time starter, a red grade or better starter, he better be a good special teams player. What use is your fourth receiver as a maybe a low-grade purple graded player? What good is a veteran receiver who's maybe your fourth best receiver? What good is he on your roster if he can't play special teams? Who do you think is playing special teams? All of those reserve guys, those reserve receivers, reserve running backs, reserve safeties, reserve linebackers, defensive linemen, reserve guy. Who do you think is playing special teams? Those guys. So if you take one of those guys who's a veteran guy, not a good special teams player, and he's also not an elite receiver, well, then he has no value to you. I mean, it's not enough value to you. He may be, if he was really good value as a receiver, he wouldn't be your fourth guy. He'd be better. If he's not better, well, then you want that young guy that maybe has ability to develop a little bit more, but is also really aggressive and really a factor on special teams. So understand, seems like you're a special teams fan, Lewis. So understand that the special teams units in the NFL, they're made up of primarily backups on the depth chart on offense and defense. So how many players you have and you keep at each position is going to directly affect what your depth chart looks on special teams like and whether you have the personnel to do it. If I told you wanted to be a really good running team, but you didn't have a good run block and offensive lineman, you didn't have a good back, it would make sense, right? Well, how are you going to be a really good special teams unit if you don't have an emphasis on the personnel to do so? And the emphasis has to be on really reserve players and role players because most of your starters are not playing on special teams. Some cases they do. Most cases they don't. Which, by the way, I always laugh when you hear things like, you know, because injuries take place all the time. Well, so-and-so's got good depth at linebacker, so they're not going to miss so-and-so. Okay, really? Yeah, they've got pretty good depth at linebacker. But now the starter goes out. So the backup Will comes in, let's say, and he's got more reps as a starter. Guess what that does? Just think about what I just said. He might be a good player, and the drop-off from the grade at the Will backer position may not be much at all. But what are you missing? Now the guy that's backing up the Will, the backup to the backup at Will, now he's your core special team starter. So what do they say about stuff runs downhill? The special teams coaches have to deal with a lot of stuff. You know, they got to go. They're often playing young guys that don't know what they're doing. you know, you move up offensive coordinator, defense coordinator, the staff. They need to have a guy and come in and play the tight end position, play the third wide, play the will backer, the nickel backer, you know. But now those guys are playing more snaps. How does it affect your special teams? Who's your backup on that unit? How good are they? Well, you move this guy up. Well, they're not going to play him a whole lot. He's the core special teams guy now. So when you give up a big play, could be because your, you know, R4 is not progressing correctly, not as athletic, not as good, breakdowns too quick. You know, all of a sudden, got a big play. You give up a big play. So understand it has tremendous value. Richard asks, what was your assessment of Jim Nagy as a scout? Jim runs a Senior Bowl now. Jim did a nice job. He was he's from that area, and it's a solid job. What was your scouting evaluation of Matt Leinart out of USC? Thought Matt would be a better player. Didn't have a great arm, but was good enough. The biggest problem Matt had was a little too Hollywood. Didn't work as hard as he needed to. That was his biggest problem. Richard also asks, what is your view on the NFL 18-game season talk? Well, I think it's foolish from a football standpoint. We know why they're doing it. They want to take the two preseason games, and make them regular season so they can justify paying full price. I think it hurts the development of your football team. Now, can you get around it? Yeah, you can do it. What you're going to see is in lieu of two preseason games, if they go forward with this, you're going to see a lot more controlled scrimmages in training camp. You're going to have to make up for that preseason games because you have to look at young players and develop players and get them ready. So that's what you're going to see that's different. But, well, I mean, it's ridiculous to be preaching health and you're going to play two more games. It's all about the money. Always is. It definitely is here. Kevin asks, looking at your Twitter feed, it's obvious you like to watch other sports besides football. Are there observations of other sports or athletes that have enhanced your football perspective? Yeah, I used to I still do it to some degree, but once we get into like October when basketball practices start on campus and you go for a scouting visit, depending on the starting time for football practice, I'd never eat lunch. So what I would do is when I go into school, I'd eat a breakfast before I went into school and I'd bring, a bagel or apple or something. And when we got done looking at film, meet with the trainers and strength coach. And sometimes there was a little bit of like an hour gap. And depending upon if I needed to meet with somebody else on the administrative or coaching staff to get more information, and that really depends on how many players you had to scout. Well, what I would do is try to sneak in, if it was convenient, a little basketball practice. Went to Indiana's practice with Bobby Knight quite a bit. You know, there's some that I like to watch if I can do it. Basketball, the concepts of the passing game, getting guys open in space, a lot of the motion offense in basketball has a lot. So, yeah, I've learned a lot. Spent a lot of time with Jerry West talking about players and how he evaluates players in basketball. So, yeah, I do. There's a lot of things. Talk with guys in hockey and baseball and how they scout and coach and the concepts. The big thing, you try to figure out is any things that they do in the evaluation that may be useful, that they do that could be useful in what you do, always looking for that. So do like it, absolutely. Kevin also asks, with respect to winning organization, what are structural qualities you have observed about the interactional relationship of position coach, coordinators, and the head coach? Well, the biggest thing that winning organizations do, you hear this saying, well, they got to be on the same page. Well, you haven't heard that before, huh? What does that really mean? Okay. You have to understand, and this is where, I'm a big believer in, hiring scouts that are from a coaching background. I think these guys that just kind of throw out a lot of buzzwords and talk about talking heads, I don't really respect those type of opinions. What I want is guys that understand how to evaluate offensive linemen because they've coached it. Understand receivers because they've coached it. Okay, so they understand in detail what a player needs to do. What I wanted to do is I wanted to have a scouting manual that is provided that's based upon integral knowledge with the position coach, the coordinators, and the head coach. What do we want from our offensive guard, our offensive tackle, our center, our quarterback, our running back, our fullback, our tight end, our H, you know, our X receiver, our Z. Every position is broken down. What are the skill sets? What are the traits that we're looking for? Okay, it does not matter, you know, how many balls he catches and yards, and I saw the highlight on SportsCenter. None of that crap matters. It's the traits you're looking for, okay? And how does that translate? That is going to get you to the production, is the traits. So you want to have detailed, structural, everybody looking on the same thing. You can't have, you know, a player, if you want a certain skill set and a certain body type to play X receiver, and you go off the chart for that and get a guy that doesn't do any of those things, doesn't make sense. I mean, would you hire a plumber to come fix electrical work? That's where it's missed. Oh, go out and look at these. Oh, yeah, these, you know, these what I call amateurish scouts that really no different than glorified fans that don't really know how to evaluate. And then you get a lot of players. And that player's good, man. They draft all those guys. I saw them play and such. Well, so what? What does that really matter? That's not what's important. How do you build a team? Not collecting talent, you're building a team. So what I've seen is the best places, and what I've always tried to structure was that we all have to get together and decide this is what, and then go into that. And I've been in places where you do that, where you don't do it, and the ones that you do it, you can't sit there and say, well, I think this. No, you have to be thinking about this together. You have to be. I mean, and here's the other thing. You know, I mean, if you're trying to shop for somebody, you know, and you know what they like, I mean, you wouldn't go buy golf clubs for somebody that hates golf. That'd be a dumb gift, right? You wouldn't buy a fishing lure or rod and reel for somebody that doesn't like the water and doesn't like to be out on the boat and doesn't like to fish. Well, then why? I mean, it may be but it's the best lure and the best rod out there. Who cares? You know what you're looking for and know where there's flexibility where you can go off the chart a little bit and you have some flexibility with how you can utilize that. Those things are really important. Can you explain the primary difference between the offensive line zone blocking schemes with Alex Gibbs when he was Denver and Howard Mudd was in Indianapolis? They're very, very similar. I can't answer that question in a timely fashion for you, but the zone blocking schemes, very, very similar. You know, in Indianapolis, they ran a little bit more stretch play stuff, but it's the zone blocking schemes are zone blocking, they're angle blocking. And so how they do it, it was a little bit more physical. Guys, that the difference was the evolving of the fact that defenses became a little bit more stout. So the only real difference is the personnel. You had to be a little bit more physical, whereas you had the undersized quick guys when Alex started it, but then people started to get bigger on defense, so we're going to punch those guys in the mouth. So that's the biggest difference, quite frankly, not schematically. Jacob asks, do you think there's a solution to the problem that guys like Zeke Elliott faces? Well, most running backs are more valuable in their contract and are devalued quicker, unlike players at other positions. Well, the solution is they want to get their contract sooner, and it makes sense. Can you extend their careers? Well, I mean, listen, it takes a little bit of luck. You got to have some breaks. Emmitt Smith played forever, but not many guys will play well forever. It's a shorter lifespan. Got to get the money when you can. There's no solution to it. I mean, for the player, you know, got to get your second contract quicker. For a team, you want to get as much out of them without having to get them that big contract. So it's not an easy fix. It's, you know, again, as a team, you can lock up a guy quicker, but, you know, and you could prevent the holdout, but do you want to do that? Do you want to lock him up? And again, with the longevity being what it is, you have a lot of dead money on a guy that's not real successful. That's why you saw Le'Veon Bell take drastic measures. I don't agree with it, but I understand why he did it. Jacob asks, why has Maryland had such a hard time keeping quality quarterbacks healthy the last few years? Well, there's nothing that they've really done. They haven't run the quarterback more than some teams, but they've had some bad luck. There's not a strategic issue. Just had bad luck. They have gotten their quarterback hit a little bit too much, and so it's been some protection issues. But it's nothing that just jumps out as, boy, this is a blinding light. It's quite frankly the biggest factor is bad luck. All right, let's get into it. We're deep enough into the show. I want to get into and go as far as we can a little bit today. Job descriptions in a 3-4 defense. And, you know, it wasn't long ago that a handful of teams in the NFL operating out of a 3-4 front, three down linemen, four linebackers. But as the Bill Walsh's West Coast offense spread across the league, in the wake of the San Francisco success, the 3-4 became increasingly popular as coaches watched Bill Parcells, which is, you know, I learned the 3-4 defense from Bill Orangeburg, who invented the 3-4 and coached for Bill. But Parcells and Belichick really kind of architected a different model 3-4. And, you know, you had the Giants do a good job against the Niners. And, you know, the Patriots and the Steelers really did a great job with 3-4 defenses. And here's the advantage back then. You could find guys that were the defensive ends in college that couldn't play defensive end in a 4-3. They were great fits as 3-4 outside backers. So you had greater value. So guys that, you know, we'll say somebody's trash is other people's treasure. 4-3 teams didn't like those guys. Steelers ate them up. It's a big reason why the Steelers have had a harder time of getting as many of those players. You know, the Kevin Greens type guys that they've gone, Greg Lloyd's, just on and on and on. You know the guys. Well, now as more teams went to the 3-4 over time, the more teams were looking for those type of players, so Steelers didn't have their pick of the litter. But I'm regressing a little bit. We'll get into more of that. So we get into about 2015. You had Rex Ryan kind of moving off to Buffalo, and then you had Wade Phillips and Vic Fangio. Then you had about half the teams in the league running 3-4s. So with more players standing up in a two-point stance, the 3-4 defenses can adapt to exotic offenses they're seeing more and more of, and they're better equipped to handle the quarterback in the shotgun with an empty backfield. Since there's only three defenders are playing with their hands on the ground, a 3-4 team can send pressure from anywhere. The offense doesn't know who's coming or where they're coming from, so it confuses offensive linemen that are trying to identify their protection responsibilities. The difference between the two systems really starts up front. The job of the defensive line in the 3-4 is not to penetrate in the backfield. It's to occupy much of the offensive line, as much of it as possible, freeze up the linebackers to make plays. So each lineman in a 3-4, in traditional 3-4, get into some of the differences of what Wade Phillips does with his 3-4, but the lineman in a traditional 3-4 is responsible for two gaps. Okay, so the nose tackle, for example, has to handle the A-gaps between the center and guard on both sides. The defensive end has to handle the B-gap between the guards and tackles on both sides. And you know, the C outside the tackle gaps. To do that, a team, as you could expect, needs what? Big, strong, long-levered defensive linemen, long arms that can control the gaps. The front three need to get their hands on offensive linemen and lock their arms out so the blockers can't get on them. They have to be strong enough so that they can't be pushed off the ball. They have to be tall enough to see over the offensive line and locate the ball carrier in the backfield. Starts with finding that nose tackle that's going to command the double teams. A 3-4 defense works best when it forces one of the guards to help the center on every play. You can force the nose tackle, can force the guard to help the center on every play. That's a win. So the prototypical nose tackle will be kind of a 6'2", 6'4", you know, 350, Haloti Ngata, B.J. Raji, Vince Wilfork type of guys. The quintessential 3-4 defensive end, kind of guy like a Calais Campbell, 6'6", 6'7", 300-pound guy, long-armed. Again, he's not penetrating, so he needs to be able to see the ball carrier over the tall tackle he's lined up against. Okay, remember we talk about, hey, boy, those undersized, short, quick guys can penetrate. Well, that's fine if you're penetrating, but you can't have short defensive ends if you're a two-gap team. Why? Think about it. You're coming off the ball, you're engaging the offensive line, and you need to be able to see the ball carrier. If you're short and you're blinded, you may have great ability to push and explode, but if you're playing at the point of attack and not penetrating, you know, you're not going to be able to see. So if you're short or long arm, you're not going to be a good fit. If you go back when Arizona won the West and went to the Super Bowl, nice little run, their defense was a big part of it. Yeah, Kurt Warner was great, Larry Fitzgerald was great, but it was their defense. And they had textbook 3-4 ends, Calais Campbell and Darnell Dockett. Those guys were really good. unless you get a J.J. Watt type of guy, the 3-4 ends are not the pass rushers that you find in 4-3. They need to sacrifice themselves for the sake of the scheme. And that type of mentality is something that teams need to identify in a player before bringing them in. You know, a 3-4 defensive end lines up over an offensive tackle, and his job is more about keeping the blockers from getting onto the linebacker than it is about him getting in the backfield and creating havoc. Some guys don't have the capacity to be that selfish. They can become a problem if they're asked to do that. You don't sign Albert Haynesworth, who's more of a selfish me guy, and ask him to do that. That's what Washington did. It was a disaster. Why? Because he had a body type of a 3-4 end, but he had an attitude of a guy that he only cared about his sacks, and you know, it's just not what they wanted him to do. Defensive end, defensive lineman get paid for sacks. In a 4-3 defense, the end gets sacks. In 3-4, the outside backer gets the sacks. They get the credit. They get the cash. So, you know, in the 3-4, the nose tackle and defensive ends line up directly across from the center and offensive tackle. So if the nose tackle forces a double team by the guard, the inside backers are going to be free to make tackles. Come up, make tackle. They're freed up. The outside backers are the true glamour position in the 3-4 defense. You know, the Lawrence Taylor, the Ricky Jacksons, the Andre Tippetts, the Kevin Greens, Elvis Dumervil, the Von Millers, the Justin Houston, the Tamba Hallees. They bring speed and pressure off the edge. They've got the strength to turn that speed into power and the athleticism to occasionally drop in coverage. Some can do that better than others, but the athletic ability, explosive speed to power is what you're looking for. When the Patriots, you know, they tried to build their offensive line, or excuse me, their defensive line with draft picks, they found their outside backers on the free agent market. You know, the Vrabels and the Darius Thomases, the Rosie Colvins, guys like that, because they were versatile and can play multiple spots at end. But also, since very few college teams played 3-4 scheme, NFL coaches are always looking for undersized college ends with pass rushing skills, but not necessarily the big, bulky body of a traditional lineman. So during workouts, we'll test prospects' agility, have them drop in the flat, throw balls at him, judge his hands, make sure he's athletic enough to open his hips. If they have the required athleticism, many great rush ends in college, defensive ends with a hand on the ground, will find a home as outside backer. If you don't do those things, probably not going to make the transition. And why they can develop their strength and be guys that can play on the edge, coming out of college they may not be, which is why New England tried to find those guys that could play a role and maybe has some experience in the league, but also improve strength at the point of attack. A 3-4 defense obviously needs two inside backers, preferably of different types. One has to be able to play over the strong side guard. The strong inside backer should be, you know, a thumper, 250-pound guy, a LaVonna Kirkland, a David Harris. The weak side inside backer is the guy who lines up on the same side as a split end. Can be a little bit smaller because the guard on the weak side isn't going to get out to him as much, allowing him to have a little bit more free space to run. So, you know, that's a Ray Lewis type of body. Will guys on that side. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what you're looking for in the front. And again, this is the front, not the coverages. We'll get into that a little later. We're going to talk about the 4-3s, the 4-3 defense. Unlike the 4-3, unlike the 3-4, the 4-3 comes with a little mystery. Unless a defense is in a fire zone blitz situation, which we'll talk about a little bit later, the offense knows what's coming. The four down linemen are going to bring the heat. You know, when they're able to get pressure on the backfield, tying up five offensive linemen with a four-man line, it's a tremendous advantage for the defense, which now has seven guys in coverage against at most five receivers. That's the basic concept. Unlike the nose tackle in a 3-4, the two tackles in a 4-3 are penetrators. One lines up on a guard, the other shaded on the center in most cases. They use their speedy first step to get into one gap they've been assigned to, get under the pads of the center of the guard who's blocking them, and to penetrate. Warren Sapp, Aaron Donald today, those type of guys. Small interior linemen aren't much of a liability in a 4-3 scheme as they are in a 3-4, which is why kind of the answer to the question of understanding personnel. Remember when the Jets drafted Dwayne Robertson? Fourth overall, they were playing a 4-3 defense under Herm Edwards. When Eric Mangini came in, immediately they converted the team to a 3-4. Robertson was lost. He didn't fit. that's, again, administratively, you know, knowing what you're doing. And he's not a guy that fit very well in a 3-4. He was a 4-3 tackle. As a nose tackle, he was too short, couldn't see the plays coming at him. And when ball carriers came through the A-gap, he couldn't get off a block to make a play, primarily because his arms weren't long enough to maintain separation. Plus, he didn't warrant a double team, which is the cardinal sin for a nose tackle. So they ended up trading him to Denver, where he contributed to the Broncos' 4-3 scheme till they switched to 3-4, and then they released him. Knowing what a guy can do and where he fits, it's not pivotal, it's essential. It's pretty much everything. The ends in the 4-3, of course, are the pass rushers and line up on the outside shoulders of the tackles. They tend to be a little lighter and considerably faster than their counterparts in the 3-4, since they need to be able to apply pressure with both speed and power. You know, the guys we've seen, you know, the Jason Pierre-Pauls, Jared Allen guys type, those are big rush, big ticket item guys. Those guys put up the big numbers and they cost the big money, and there's no question. One of the reasons why New England's been successful in running a lot of the 3-4 principles is it doesn't cost as much. You're running a 4-3, and you want an elite pass rusher. They're going to cost a lot of money. You're big-ticket item guys. Well, you run 3-4s, those guys don't cost as much. They're more fungible. You can find guys that have the body types, more of them, and you do more things. If you can teach it, you know it, how to play it, you know, I think that that's a big part of where you want to focus your energies and spending your money. The linebacking core in a 4-3 features three distinct positions: the Mike backer, which is the middle backer, the Will backer, which is the weak side backer, and the Sam backer, which is a strong side backer. Compare the inside triangles in each system. In a 4-3, you see smaller, quicker linebackers line up behind a pair of leaner, quicker tackles. In the 3-4, you have big, stout nose tackles playing in front of a pair of big inside backers. The 4-3 Mike backer tends to be small and quick since he's going to drop in coverage more often, particularly to the deep middle and cover 2. In the 4-3, the Mike backer will have two tackles in front of him, occupying two or three blockers, so he's free to run to the ball. The Keekleys and the guys like the Zach Thomas and London Fletcher have been a big part of those type of fits and rolls. The Will backer is the shorter, faster guy who can go sideline to sideline and make plays. And team can hide him behind one of the defensive tackles and virtually guarantee that an opponent won't get a blocker on him. So it can afford an undersized player at the position. Where the 3-4 front can find a fit for somebody's Levante David, it's a little bit easier. The Sam backer is a bit of a hybrid player. Lining up on the strong side, he's usually the tallest, strongest linebacker, and they could fit probably as well as an outside backer in the 3-4. He has to be stout enough to take on the tight end or even the right tackle when the offenses run power plays at him, but he also must be agile enough to cover tight ends and the safety, and when the safety is inserted into the box to provide run support. Junior Seau, Khalil Mack type of guys kind of fit that role. Look, in a 4-3 defense, every player is responsible for one gap. Defenders often switch gaps in an effort to confuse an offense. We call stunts, twists, games. We'll get into that. So finding the right pieces. What are you looking for in these type of players? That's really the key. And so you look for the big guys. You want to look at the first step. You want the guys that use their quickness off the ball and can penetrate. Guys that obviously fit the 4-3 as a penetrator. Guys that more strength at the point of attack, as I've explained, more guys that can be fits in the 3-4 two-gap front. So I remember when B.J. Raji came out of Boston College, he could burst through a gap. He had a great Senior Bowl practices. And, you know, like most guys, they like to use this quickness to get off the ball and penetrate. Huh, be a good fit for a 4-3 team shopping for a tackle. Now, he's drafted by Green Bay. They saw him as a guy that they could be the main focus to their conversion from a 4-3 to a 3-4. They saw him as a nose tackle. Even though he's on the short side, 6'2", and his best asset, his quickness, wouldn't be utilized. But they came a really good defense against the run and second best overall. Now, Raji struggled as a rookie. He split time between nose tackle and defensive end, but he started all 16 games and led all NFL nose tackles in sacks that year and developed into a Pro Bowl player. Not every guy can fit any system. Raji was quick enough to play in a 4-3, but he was a 340-pound guy, could play on the nose. Glenn Dorsey was a high pick, and this was an example of when they had people in Kansas City that were didn't know how to run personnel. They had a couple of high picks on the defensive line, again, not understanding what they're looking for. But Glenn Dorsey was drafted fifth overall, played tackle in their 4-3 defense, but when they switched to a 3-4 front, at 6'1", 290 pounds, he was too small to play nose tackle. He was moved to defensive end. Ill-fitted. Problem. I remember when Ndamukong Suh came out in the 2010 draft, 6'4". He's versatile enough. He could play in either system. He's 300 pounds. He's built like Tommy Harris, Chris Jenkins. He seemed more like a 4-3 tackle than a 3-4 nose. The Lions took him. Second pick, plugged him into their 4-3 front, became a rookie of the year. 5 years later, he signed as a free agent, made a lot of money with Miami, $60 million. Had he gone two picks later to Washington, slot him into the 3-4 front, don't know what would have happened. So no matter which system you're looking for, there are a couple of indicators that I think you need to look at. One of the things, again, looking at film is great, and that's what you look for in how a guy plays. You can see explosion. You can see production on film. When we get to workouts in the combine, there are things that you look for that are good indicators of a guy's explosiveness. I like to take what I call explosive number formula. You heard me talk about this around draft time. If you look at these numbers, it gives you a good indicator of how explosive a player is. If you take the bench press, which is the number of reps at 225 pounds, and you add the vertical leap and then the standing broad jump, that gives you a good indication. Again, explosiveness from the upper body to shoot your hands. You know, so why does the bench press important? Because when you're benching weight, you're shooting your hands. That's what you do at the line of scrimmage with the defensive guy. You're shooting your hands, offensive and defensive linemen. Why wouldn't that be important? Very important. You got to be able to do that on the field, but if you can't do it in the weight room, you're not don't have good strength, you're not going to be able to shoot your hands and be effective. So you look at that in the vertical jump, the ability to explode on the lower body, and the standing broad jump, again, gives you good explosive numbers. You add those numbers together, it's important. Now, at the snap of the ball, the front seven, the offensive line, defensive line, the offensive is going to engage physically. It's a series of adjustments. We need to be able to project who has the athleticism to win the battle in the trenches. The formula gives you a good explosive indicator and has a tremendous impact in evaluating a player. When you have a number in the 70 range or higher, that's pretty good. So you look at, for example, and this is a case of another Chiefs mistake. They took Tyson Jackson third overall. Red flag. Wasn't explosive. His numbers were 57. You looked at the film, it showed that. But old Paoli there didn't see it, didn't understand that. Huge mistake taking a guy that high that clearly was not a fit. Never developed in the type of player that you take that high. I mean, he was a guy that was, you know, down-the-line guy. Had value somewhere in the third round, playing a role, not very explosive. Important to understand. On the other hand, Don Terry Poe, who was considered an underachiever at Memphis, Tyson Jackson was kind of an all-SEC, all-American player. Don Terry Poe was at Memphis, athlete, wasn't as good a player, been a much better NFL player. They took him 11. Really good combine numbers, really good explosion numbers. His explosion number was 81.25. Went to the Pro Bowl after his second season. Again, don't listen to the standard rules. Oh, the film tells you everything. The film doesn't tell you everything. That's why we do the workout numbers. You got to combine them both. You got to understand it. You got to know how a guy projects. Important thing. So, listen, you look at those explosion numbers, it can help you eliminate a player, no question about it. Production ratio, I like to look at that. So when I'm looking at film, I like to look at sacks plus tackles for losses divided by the number of games played, and that gives you a production ratio. But you got to put that in perspective, level of competition, and not just, oh, name-brand team versus unbrand team, but you got to know the personnel on all those teams. Maybe a really low brand, but if you're going up against a really good tackle, it's not about name brand. It's the quality of player you're going up against. You could be going up against a really name brand team as a weak tackle. Numbers are going to be inflated. So got to look at that. I'm looking in that ratio for somebody that's at least 1.0 or better. You take a look at those same, you know, type of formulas, that gives you a good indication. So the production number is a prospect's track record of productivity. Neither it nor the explosion number is a, you know, predictor of success, surefire, but it gives you an idea, another tool to use. And so it just brings you the physical skills and the productivity that are indicators of success or not, not the be-all to end-all. I get asked this a lot. How long does it take to convert a team from a 4-3 scheme to a 3-4 team and vice versa? If a team is smart about it, it's going to take two off seasons. So let's say a team is switching from a 4-3 to a 3-4 team. Atlanta and Tennessee did it fairly recently, a few years ago, and Buffalo, Chicago, and Denver as well. So maybe three of the front seven guys will have the skills that could translate into the 3-4. That means it needs four guys to fill out that front seven. A team should be able to make that conversion in two drafts, one free agency period, two tops. Cost you about $40 million, but you could do that. The other problem, though, if you don't have as many, players to fit, it's going to take longer, common sense. You're going to make that move. You better make the move because you think it's going to benefit you and you have the personnel that where it fits. The problem with making drastic changes, because that's all a coach knows and that's what he believes in, you better stick to it, because you're going to change your personnel to fit what he does. And if you turn around and fire the guy and change systems in 3 years, guess what? You're rebuilding again. That's why bad organizations are always rebuilding. Good organizations have stability. They don't listen to the media or the fans calling for coaches' heads. They stick to a plan. They work the plan, and eventually they get the plan to work. So the bigger problem is finding players. When most of the NFL, like I said earlier, played in a 4-3 scheme, a 3-4 team like the Steelers face a little competition for that kind of player. Once half the league started to run a 3-4, everybody was looking for those massive nose tackles and looking for those defensive ends that could be a stand-up rusher. Harder to find the guys. Everybody's looking for it. You know, it's what one man's trash is another man's treasure. Well, now everybody's looking at it as a treasure. Find those guys. So keep that in mind, that building a roster becomes very competitive when you've got more people running like systems. So, all right, we're going to leave it there for the day. We're going to get into some of the problems with tackling, one of my pet peeves. We're going to get into that. We're going to talk a little bit about how we kind of mix things up and the best of both worlds and the 4-3, 3-4 teams, because we've talked about the 4-3. We've talked about the 3-4. Now we're going to talk about morphing the system a little bit, what works better, and why teams are mixing it up a little bit. So keep it here on the Landry Football Podcast. Spread the word, will you? This podcast is made possible by you listening. You're getting it out to more people. Can't continue it if we don't have the listens and we can't get people that are involved in the process. And we've got some really good people that are joining the family as sponsors coming up. And that's the key to making this podcast work. So if you like it, let us know. Give us feedback. But more important, listen and share it with a dozen friends or so. You can do that. We can keep this podcast going, and the uniqueness of what we do here, we'd like to keep up. We can do that, again, as long as we have your support. Appreciate you joining us. Check out LandryFootball.com for more detailed information from around the college and pro game. We'll talk to you Thursday, everybody, on another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is a crush performance with Jeff Crichel Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
When we look at the long-term athlete development programs, I just want to talk here about some of the fundamentals that we need to think about. If you're an athlete looking to chase down a dream and maybe wear your country's flag or get that college scholarship or even that pro contract, there's things you need to think about. And it's never too late. We've seen athletes not start a sport till their late teens and become not just great players or good players, but impact players at the highest level. We've also seen, of course, we know the stories of the young Tiger Woods phenomenons in tennis, Andre Agassi, and you know, different sports where they've started young, stuck to one sport their entire lives, and managed somehow to dominate and become the best in the world. There's no one single path for all. But we do know that there are some principles that can increase your odds. Let's talk about it.
Crush Performance with Jeff Crochelle can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.